Dragon Tears by Dean Kuntz. This book is for some special people who live too far away, Ed and Carol Gorman, with the wish that our modern world really had shrunk to one small town, as the media philosophers insist it has. Then we could meet at the little cafe down on Main Street at Maple Avenue to have lunch, talk, and laugh. Part 1. This Old Honky-Tonk of Fools. You know, a dream is like a river, ever-changing as it flows. And a dreamer's just a vessel that must follow where it goes. Trying to learn from what's behind you and never knowing what's in store makes each day a constant battle just to stay between the shores. The River, Garth Brooks, Victoria Shaw. Rush headlong and hard at life or just sit home and wait. All things good and all the wrong will come to you, it's fate. Hear the music, dance if you can. Dress in rags or wear your jewels. Drink your choice, nurse your fear. In this old honky-tonk of fools, the Book of Counted Sorrows. Tuesday was a fine California day, full of sunshine and promise, until Harry Lyon had to shoot someone at lunch. For breakfast, sitting at his kitchen table, he ate toasted English muffins with lemon marmalade and drank strong black Jamaican coffee. A pinch of cinnamon gave the brew a pleasantly spicy taste. The kitchen window provided a view of the green belt that wound through Los Cabos, a sprawling condominium development in Irvine. As president of the Homeowners Association, Harry drove the three gardeners hard and rigorously monitored their work, ensuring that the trees, shrubs, and grass were as neatly trimmed as a landscape in a fairy tale, as if maintained by platoons of gardening elves with hundreds of tiny shears. As a child, he had enjoyed fairy tales even more than children usually did. In the worlds of the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen, springtime hills were always flawlessly green, velvet smooth. Order prevailed. Villains invariably met with justice, and the virtuous were rewarded, though sometimes only after hideous suffering. Hansel and Gretel didn't die in the witch's oven. The crone herself was roasted alive therein. Instead of stealing the queen's newborn daughter, Rumpelstiltskin was foiled and, in his rage, tore himself apart. In real life during the last decade of the 20th century, Rumpelstiltskin would probably get the queen's daughter. He would no doubt addict her to heroin, turn her out as a prostitute, confiscate her earnings, beat her for pleasure, hack her to pieces, and escape justice by claiming that society's intolerance for bad-tempered, evil-minded trolls had driven him temporarily insane. Harry swallowed the last of his coffee and sighed. Like a lot of people, he longed to live in a better world. Before going to work, he washed the dishes and utensils, dried them, and put them away. He loathed coming home to mess and clutter. At the foyer mirror by the front door, he paused to adjust the knot in his tie. He slipped into a navy blue blazer and checked to be sure the weapon in his shoulder holster made no telltale bulge. As on every workday for the past 6 months, he avoided traffic-packed freeways, following the same surface streets to the Multi-Agency Law Enforcement Special Project Center in Laguna Niguel, a route he had mapped out to minimize travel time. He had arrived at the office as early as 8:15 and late as 8:28, but he had never been tardy. That Tuesday, when he parked his Honda in the shadowed lot on the west side of the two-story building, the car clock showed 8:21. His wristwatch confirmed the time. Indeed, all of the clocks in Harry's condominium and the one on his desk in his office would be displaying 8:21. He synchronized all of his clocks twice a week. Standing beside the car, he drew deep, relaxing breaths. Rain had fallen overnight, scrubbing the air clean. The March sunshine gave the morning a glow as golden as the flesh of a ripe peach. To meet Laguna Niguel architectural standards, The Special Projects Center was a three-story Mediterranean-style building with a columned promenade. Surrounded by lush azaleas and tall melaleucas with lacy branches, it bore no resemblance to most police facilities. Some of the cops, who worked out of special projects, thought it looked too effete, but Harry liked it. The institutional decor of the interior had little in common with the picturesque exterior. Blue vinyl tile floors, pale gray walls, acoustic ceilings. However, its air of orderliness and efficiency was comforting. Even at that early hour, people were on the move through the lobby and hallways, mostly men with solid physique and self-confident attitude that marked career cops. Only a few were in uniform. Special projects drew on plainclothes homicide detectives and undercover operatives from federal, state, county, and city agencies to facilitate criminal investigations spread over numerous jurisdictions. Special projects teams, sometimes whole task forces, dealt with youth gang killings, serial murders, pattern rapists, and large-scale narcotics activities. Harry shared a second-floor office with Connie Gulliver. His half of the room was softened by a small palm, Chinese evergreens, and the leafy trailers of a pothos. Her half had no plants. On his desk were only a blotter, pen set, and small brass clock. Heaps of files, loose papers, and photographs were stacked on hers. Surprisingly, Connie had gotten to the office first. She was standing at the window, her back to him. "Good morning," he said. "Is it?" she asked sourly. She turned to him. She was wearing badly scuffed Reeboks, blue jeans, a red and brown checkered blouse, and a brown corduroy jacket. The jacket was one of her favorites, worn so often that the cords were threadbare in places, the cuffs were frayed, and the inner arm creased in the sleeves appeared to be as permanent as river valleys carved in bedrock by eons of flowing water. In her hand was an empty paper cup from which she had been drinking coffee. She wadded it almost angrily and threw it on the floor. It bounced and came to rest in Harry's half of the room. "Let's hit the streets," she said, heading toward the hall door. Staring at the cup on the floor, he said, "What's the rush?" "We're cops, aren't we? So let's don't stand around with our thumbs up our asses. Let's go do cop stuff." As she moved out of sight into the hall, he stared at the cup on his side of the room. With his foot, he nudged it across the imaginary line that divided the office. He followed Connie to the door, but halted at the threshold. He glanced back at the paper cup. By now, Connie would be at the end of the corridor, maybe even descending the stairs. Harry hesitated, returned to the crumpled cup, and tossed it in the waste can. He disposed of the other two cups as well. He caught up with Connie in the parking lot, where she yanked open the driver's door of their unmarked project sedan. As he got in the other side, she started the car, twisting the key so savagely that it should have snapped off in the ignition. "Have a bad night?" he inquired. She slammed the car into gear. He said, "Headache?" She reversed too fast out of the parking lot. He said, "Thorn in the paw?" The car shot toward the street. Harry braced himself, but he was not worried about her driving. She could handle a car far better than she handled people. "Want to talk about whatever's wrong?" "No." For someone who lived on the edge, who seemed fearless in moments of danger, who went skydiving and breakneck dirt biking on weekends, Connie Gulliver was frustratingly, primly reticent when it came to making personal revelations. They had been working together for 6 months, and although Harry knew a great many things about her, sometimes it seemed he knew nothing important about her. "It might help to talk about it," Harry said. "It wouldn't help." Harry watched her surreptitiously as she drove, wondering if her anger arose from man problems. He had been a cop for 15 years and had seen enough of human treachery and misery to know that men were the source of most women's troubles. He knew nothing whatsoever of Connie's love life, however, not even whether she had one. "Does it have to do with this case?" "No." He believed her. She tried, with apparent success, never to be stained by the filth in which her life as a cop required her to wade. She said, "But I sure do want to nail this son of a bitch Durner. I think we're close." Doyle Durner, a drifter who moved in the surfer subculture, was wanted for questioning in a series of rapes that had grown more violent incident by incident until the most recent victim had been beaten to death, a 16-year-old schoolgirl. Derner was their primary suspect because he was known to have undergone a circumferential autologous penile engorgement. A plastic surgeon in Newport Beach liposuctioned fat out of Derner's waist and injected it into his penis to increase its thickness. The procedure was definitely not recommended by the American Medical Association, but if the surgeon had a big mortgage to pay and the patient was obsessed with his circumference, the forces of the marketplace prevailed over concerns about postoperative complications. The circumference of Derner's manhood had been increased 50%, such a dramatic enlargement that it must have caused him occasional discomfort. By all reports, he was happy with the results, not because he was likely to impress women, but because he was likely to hurt them, which was the whole point. The victim's description of their attacker's freakish difference had helped authorities zero in on Derner, and three of them had noted the tattoo of a snake on his groin, which had been recorded in his police file upon his conviction for two rapes in Santa Barbara 8 years ago. By noon that Tuesday, Harry and Connie had spoken with workers and customers at three hangouts popular among surfers and other beach habitués in Laguna: a shop that sold surfboards and related gear, a yogurt and health food store, and a dimly lighted bar in which a dozen customers were drinking Mexican beers at 11 o'clock in the morning. If you could believe what they said, which you couldn't, they had never heard of Doyle Derner and did not recognize him in the photo they were shown. In the car between stops, Connie regaled Harry with the latest items in her collection of outrages. "You hear about the woman in Philadelphia? They found two infants dead of malnutrition in her apartment and dozens of crack cocaine vials scattered all over the place. She's so doped up her baby starved to death, and you know all they could charge her with? Reckless endangerment." Harry only sighed. When Connie was in the mood to talk about what she sometimes called the continuing crisis, or when she was more sarcastic, the pre-millennium cotillion, or, in her bleaker moments, these new dark ages, no response was expected from him. She was quite satisfied to make a monologue of it. She said, "A guy in New York killed his girlfriend's 2-year-old daughter, pounded her with his fists, and kicked her because she was dancing in front of the TV, interfering with his view. Probably watching Wheel of Fortune, didn't want to miss a shot of Vanna White's fabulous legs." Like most cops, Connie had an acute sense of black humor. It was a defense mechanism. Without it, you'd be driven crazy or become terminally depressed by the endless encounters with human evil and perversity that were central to the job. To those whose knowledge of police life came from half-baked television programs, real-life cop humor could seem crude and insensitive at times, though no good cop gave a rat's ass for what anybody but another cop thought of him. "There's this suicide prevention center up in Sacramento," Connie said, braking for a traffic light. "One of the counselors got sick of getting calls from this depressive senior citizen, so he and a friend went to the old guy's apartment, held him down, slashed his wrists and throat." Sometimes beneath Connie's darkest humor, Harry perceived a bitterness that was not common to cops. She was so self-contained that it was usually difficult to determine exactly what she was feeling. Unlike Connie, Harry was an optimist. To remain an optimist, however, he found it necessary not to dwell on human folly and malevolence the way she did. Trying to change the subject, he said, "How about lunch? I know this great little Italian trattoria with oilcloth on the tables, wine bottles for candle holders, good gnocchi, fabulous manicotti." She grimaced. "Nah, let's just grab tacos at a drive-thru and eat on the fly." They compromised on a burger joint half a block north of Pacific Coast Highway. It had about a dozen customers and a Southwest decor. The tops of the whitewashed wood tables were sealed beneath an inch of acrylic, pasted flame pattern upholstery on the chairs, potted cacti, Gorman and Parkinson lithographs. They ought to have been selling black bean soup and mesquite-grilled beef instead of burgers and fries. Harry and Connie were eating at a small table along one wall, a dry grilled chicken sandwich for him, shoestring fries and sloppy aromatic cheeseburger for her, when the tall man entered in a flash of sunlight that flared off the glass door. He stopped at the hostess station and looked around. Although the guy was neatly groomed and well-dressed in light gray cords, white shirt, and dark gray ultra-suede jacket, something about him instantly made Harry uneasy. His vague smile and mildly distracted air gave him a curiously professorial look. His face was round and soft, with a weak chin and pale lips. He looked timid, not threatening. Nevertheless, Harry's gut tightened. Cop instinct. Sammy Shamro had been known as Sam the Sham back when he was a Los Angeles advertising agency executive blessed with a singular creative talent and cursed with a taste for cocaine. That had been 3 years ago, an eternity. Now he crawled out of the packing crate in which he lived, trailing the rags and crumpled newspapers that served as his bedding. He stopped crawling as soon as he moved beyond the drooping boughs of the oleander bush which grew at the edge of the vacant lot and concealed most of the crate. For a while he stayed on his hands and knees, his head hanging down, staring at the alley pavement. Long ago he had ceased being able to afford the high-end drugs that had so thoroughly ruined him. Now he suffered from a cheap wine headache. He felt as if his skull had fallen open while he slept, allowing the wind to plant a handful of prickly burrs in the surface of his exposed brain. He was not in the least disoriented. Because the sunlight fell straight down into the alley, leaving shadows only close along the back walls of the buildings on the north side, Sammy knew it was nearly noon. Although he hadn't worn a watch, seen a calendar, held a job, or had an appointment to keep in 3 years, he was always aware of the season, the month, and the day. Tuesday. He was acutely cognizant of where he was, Laguna Beach, of how he had gotten there. Every mistake, every self-indulgence, every stupid, self-destructive act retained in vivid detail, and of what he could expect for the rest of his life. Shame, deprivation, struggle, regret. The worst aspect of his fall from grace was the stubborn clarity of his mind, which even massive quantities of alcohol could pollute only briefly. The prickly burrs of his hangover headache were a mild inconvenience when compared to the sharp thorns of memory and self-awareness that bristled deeper in his brain. He heard someone approaching. Heavy footsteps. A faint limp, 1 foot scraping lightly against the pavement. He knew that tread. He began to tremble. He kept his head down and closed his eyes, willing the footsteps to grow fainter and recede into the silence. But they grew louder, nearer. Then stopped directly in front of him.
You figured it out yet?
It was the deep, gravelly voice that had recently begun to haunt Sammy's nightmares. But he was not asleep now. This was not the monster of his turbulent dreams. This was the real creature that inspired the nightmares. Reluctantly, Sammy opened his grainy eyes and looked up. The rat man stood over him, grinning.
You figured it out yet?
Tall, burly, his mane of hair disordered, his tangled beard flecked with unidentifiable bits and chunks of matter too disgusting to contemplate, the rat man was a terrifying figure. Where his beard did not conceal it, his face was gnarled by scars as if he had been poked and slashed with a white-hot soldering iron. His large nose was hooked and crooked, his lips spotted with weeping sores. Upon his dark and diseased gums, his teeth perched like broken, age-yellowed marble tombstones. The gravelly voice grew louder.
Maybe you're already dead.
The only ordinary thing about the rat man was his clothes. Tennis shoes, charity shop khakis, cotton shirt, and a badly weathered black raincoat all stained and heavily wrinkled. It was the uniform of a lot of street people who, some by their own fault and some not, had fallen through the cracks in the floorboards of modern society into the shadowy crawl space beneath. The voice softened dramatically as the rat man bent forward, leaned closer.
Already dead and in hell? Could it be?
Of all the extraordinary things about the rat man, his eyes were the most disturbing. They were intensely green, unusually green, but the queerest thing was that the black pupils were elliptical, like the pupils of a cat or reptile. The eyes made the rat man's body seem like merely a disguise, a rubber suit, as if something unspeakable peered out of a costume at a world on which it had not been born, but which it coveted. The rat man lowered his voice even further to a raspy whisper.
dead in hell and me the demon assigned to torture you?
Knowing what was coming, having endured it before, Sammy tried to scramble to his feet. But the Ratman, quick as wind, kicked him before he could get out of the way. The kick caught him in the left shoulder, just missing his face, and it didn't feel like a sneaker, but like a jackboot, as if the foot inside was entirely of bone or horn or the stuff of which a beetle's carapace was formed. Sammy curled into the fetal position, protecting his head with his folded arms as best he could. The Ratman kicked him again, again, left foot, right foot, left foot, almost as if doing a little dance, a sort of jig. One kick and a two kick and a one kick and a two. Not making a sound, neither snarling in rage nor laughing scornfully, not breathing hard in spite of the exertion. The kicking stopped. Sammy drew into an even tighter ball, like a pill bug curling around his pains. The alleyway was unnaturally silent, except for Sammy's soft weeping, for which he loathed himself. The traffic noise from the nearby streets had completely faded. The oleander bush behind him no longer rustled in the breeze. When Sammy angrily told himself to be a man, when he swallowed his sobs, the quietude was death perfect. He dared to open his eyes and peek between his arms, looking toward the far end of the alley. Blinking to clear his tear-veiled vision, he was able to see two cars halted in the street beyond. The drivers, visible only as shadowy shapes, waited motionlessly. Closer, directly in front of his face, an inch-long wingless earwig, strangely out of its environment of rotting wood and dark places, was frozen in the process of crossing the alley. The twin prongs on the insect's back end appeared wicked, dangerous, and were curled up like the stinging tail of a scorpion, though in reality it was harmless. Some of its six legs touched the pavement, and others were lifted in mid-stride. It didn't move even one of its segmented antennae, as if frozen by fear or poised to attack. Sammy shifted his gaze to the end of the alley. Out in the street, the same cars were stalled in the same spots as before. The people in them sat like mannequins. The insect again, unmoving, as still as if dead and pinned to an entomologist's specimen board. Warily, Sammy lowered his crossed arms from his head. Groaning, he rolled onto his back and looked up reluctantly at his assailant. Looming, the Ratman seemed 100 feet tall. He studied Sammy with solemn interest.
"Do you want to live?"
Sammy was surprised not by the question, but by his inability to answer it. He was caught between the fear of death and the need to die. Each morning he was disappointed when he woke and found that he was still among the living, and each night when he curled up in his rag and paper bedding, he hoped for endless sleep. Yet day after day he struggled to obtain sufficient food, to find a warm place on those rare cold nights when California's climactic grace deserted it, to stay dry when it rained so as to avoid pneumonia, and he looked both ways before crossing a street. Perhaps he did not want to live, but wanted only the punishment of living.
"I'd like it better if you wanted to live," the Ratman said quietly. "More fun for me."
Sammy's heart was beating too thunderously. Each pulse throbbed hardest in the bruised flesh that marked the impact points of the Ratman's ferocious kicks.
"You've got 36 hours to live. Better do something, don't you think? The clock is running. Tick-tock, tick-tock."
"Why are you doing this to me?"
Sammy asked plaintively. Instead of replying, the Ratman said,
"Midnight tomorrow, the rats will come for you."
"I've never done anything to you."
The scars on the tormentor's brutal face grew livid.
"Chew out your eyes."
"Please."
His pale lips tightened as he spoke, revealing more of his rotting teeth.
"Strip away your lips while you scream. Nibble your tongue."
As the Ratman grew increasingly agitated, his demeanor became not more feverish, but cold. His reptilian eyes seemed to radiate a chill that found its way into Sammy's flesh and into the deepest reaches of his mind.
"Who are you?"
Sammy asked, not for the first time. The Ratman did not answer. He swelled with rage. His thick, filthy fingers curled to form fists. Uncurled, curled, uncurled. He kneaded the air as if he hoped to squeeze blood from it. What are you? Sammy wondered, but dared not ask.
Rats, hissed the rat man.
Afraid of what was about to happen, although it had happened before, Sammy scooted backward on his butt toward the oleander bush that half-concealed his packing crate, trying to put some distance between himself and the towering hobo.
Rats,
the rat man repeated, and he began to tremble. It was starting. Sammy froze, too terrified to move. The rat man's trembling became a shudder. The shudder escalated into violent shaking. His oily hair whipped about his head, his arms jerked, his legs jigged, and his black raincoat flapped as if he were in a cyclone, but no wind huffed or howled. The March air was as preternaturally still as it had been since the hulking vagrant's appearance, as if the world were but a painted stage and the two of them only actors upon it. Becalmed on reefs of blacktop, Sammy Shamro finally stood. He was driven to his feet by fear of the roiling tide of claws, sharp teeth, and red eyes that would soon rise around him. Beneath his clothes, the rat man's body churned like a burlap sack full of angry rattlesnakes. He was changing. His face melted and reformed as if he stood in a forge controlled by some mad deity intent on molding a series of monstrosities, each of which would be more terrible than the one before it. Gone were the livid scars, gone were the reptilian eyes, gone the wild beard and tangled hair, gone the cruel mouth. For a moment his head was nothing but a mass of undifferentiated flesh, a lump of oozing mush, red with blood, then red-brown and darker, glistening like something that had been poured out of a dog food can. Abruptly, the tissue solidified, and his head was composed of rats clinging to one another, a ball of rats, tails drooping like Rastafarian dreadlocks, fierce eyes as scarlet as drops of radiant blood. Where hands should have hung from his sleeves, rats bristled out of frayed cuffs. The heads of other rodents began to poke from between the buttons of his bulging shirt. Though he had seen all of this before, Sammy tried to scream. His swollen tongue stuck to the roof of his throat. A scream wouldn't help anyway. He had screamed before during other encounters with his tormentor, and no one had responded. The rat man came apart as if he were a rickety scarecrow in a sundering storm, pieces of his body dropping away. When each part hit the pavement, it was an individual rat. Whiskered, wet-nosed, sharp-toothed, squealing, the repellent creatures swarmed over one another, long tails lashing left and right. More rats poured out of his shirt and from under the cuffs of his trousers, far more than his clothes could possibly have contained. A score of them, 20, 80, more than 100. Like a deflating balloon that had been crafted in the form of a man, his clothes settled slowly to the pavement. Then each garment was transformed as well. The wrinkled lumps of cloth sprouted heads and limbs and produced more rodents until both the rat man and his reeking wardrobe had been replaced by a seething mound of vermin squirming over and under one another with the boneless agility that made their kind so repulsive. Sammy could not get his breath. The air grew even more leaden than it had been. Whereas the wind had died earlier, an unnatural stillness now seemed to settle over deeper levels of the natural world, until the fluidity of oxygen and nitrogen molecules declined drastically, as if the atmosphere had begun to thicken into a liquid which he could draw into his lungs only with the greatest effort. Now that the ratman's body had disintegrated into scores of squirming beasts, the transformed corpus abruptly dispersed. The fat, sleek rats erupted out of the mound, fleeing in all directions, scuttling away from Sammy, but also swarming around him over his shoes and between his legs. That hateful living tide spilled into the shadows along the buildings and into the vacant lot, where it either drained into holes in the building walls and in the earth, holes that Sammy could not see, or simply vanished. A sudden breeze harried crisp, dead leaves and scraps of paper ahead of it. The swish of tires and the rumble of engines arose as cars on the main street moved past the mouth of the alley. A bee buzzed by Sammy's face. He was able to breathe again. He stood for a moment in the bright noon light, gasping. The worst thing was that it had all happened in sunshine, in in the open air, without smoke and mirrors and clever lighting and silk threads and trap doors and the standard tools of a magician's craft. Sammy had crawled out of his crate with the good intention of starting his day in spite of his hangover. Maybe look for discarded aluminum cans to redeem at a recycling center, maybe do a little panhandling along the boardwalk. Now the hangover was gone, but he still didn't feel like facing the world. On unsteady legs, he returned to the oleander bush. The boughs were heavily laden with red flowers. He pushed them aside and stared at the large wooden crate under them. He picked up a stick and poked at the rags and newspapers inside the big box, expecting a couple of rats to erupt from hiding. But they had gone elsewhere. Sammy dropped to his knees and crawled into his haven, letting the draperies of oleander fall shut behind him. From his pile of meager possessions in the back of the crate, he removed an unopened bottle of cheap burgundy and unscrewed the cap. He took a long pull of the warmish wine. Sitting with his back against the wooden wall, clutching the bottle in both hands, he tried to forget what he had seen. As far as he could see, forgetting was his only hope of coping. He could not manage the problems of everyday life anymore, so how could he expect to deal with something as extraordinary as the Rat Man? A brain steeped in too many grams of cocaine, peppered with too many other drugs, and marinated in alcohol, could produce the most amazing zoo of hallucinated creatures. And when his conscience got the better of him and he struggled to fulfill one of his periodic pledges of sobriety, withdrawal led to delirium tremens, which were populated by an even more colorful, threatening phantasmagoria of beasts. But none of them was as memorable and deeply disturbing as the Rat Man. He took another generous swallow of wine and leaned his head back against the wall of the crate, holding fast to the bottle with both hands. Year by year, day by day, Sammy had found it increasingly difficult to distinguish between reality and fantasy. He had long ago ceased to trust his perceptions. Yet of one thing he was dismayingly certain. The Rat Man was real. Impossible, fantastical, inexplicable, but real. Sammy expected to find no answers to the questions that haunted him. But he could not stop asking, what was this creature? Where did it come from? Why did it want to torment and kill a grizzled, beaten-down street person whose death, or continued existence, was of little or no consequence to the world? He drank more wine. 36 hours. Tick, tock, tick, tock. Cop instinct. When the citizen in the gray cords, white shirt, and dark gray jacket entered the restaurant, Connie noticed him and knew he was bent in some way. When she saw that Harry had also noticed, her interest in the guy increased dramatically because Harry had a nose that would make a bloodhound envious. Cop instinct is less instinct than a sharply honed talent for observation and the good sense to correctly interpret whatever is observed. With Connie, it was more a subconscious awareness than a calculated monitoring of everyone who crossed her line of sight. The suspect stood just inside the door near the cash register, waiting while the hostess seated a young couple at a table near one of the big front windows. He appeared ordinary at first glance, even harmless, but on closer inspection, Connie could identify the incongruities that had caused her subconscious to recommend a closer look at the man. No signs of tension were visible in his rather bland face, and his posture was relaxed, but his hands were fisted tightly at his sides, as if he could barely control an urgent need to strike at someone. His vague smile reinforced the air of absent-mindedness that clung to him, but the smile kept coming and going, flickering uncertainly, a subtle testament to inner turmoil. His sport coat was buttoned, which was odd because he wasn't wearing a tie and because the day was warm. More important, the coat did not hang properly. Its outer and inner pockets seemed filled with something heavy that pulled it out of shape, and it bulged over his belt buckle, as if concealing a handgun jammed under the waistband of his pants. Of course, cop instinct wasn't always reliable. The coat might just be old and out of shape. The guy might actually be the absent-minded professor he appeared to be, in which case his coat might be stuffed with nothing more sinister than a pipe, tobacco pouch, slide rule, calculator, lecture notes, and all sorts of items he had slipped into his pockets without quite realizing it. Harry, whose voice had trailed off in mid-sentence, slowly put down his chicken sandwich. He was intently focused on the man in the misshapen coat. Connie had picked up a few shoestring French fries. She dropped them onto the plate instead of eating them, and she wiped her greasy fingers on her napkin, all the while trying to watch the new customer without obviously staring at him. The hostess, a petite blonde in her 20s, returned to the reception area after seating the couple by the window, and the man in the ultra suede coat smiled. She spoke to him, he replied, and the blonde laughed politely as if what he'd said was mildly amusing. When the customer said something more and the hostess laughed again, Connie relaxed slightly. She reached for a couple of fries. The newcomer seized the hostess by her belt, jerked her toward him, and grabbed a handful of her blouse. His assault was so sudden and unexpected, his moves so cat-quick that he had lifted her off the floor before she began to scream. As if she weighed nothing, he threw her at the nearby diners. Oh, shit. Connie pushed back from the table and came to her feet, reaching under her jacket and behind to the revolver that was holstered in the small of her back. Harry rose too, his own revolver in hand.
Police!
His warning was drowned out by the sickening crash of the young blonde slamming into a table which tipped sideways. The diners toppled out of their chairs and glasses shattered. All over the restaurant, people looked up from their food, startled by the uproar. The stranger's flamboyance and savagery might just mean he was on drugs, or he might also be genuinely psychotic. Connie took no chances, dropping into a crouch as she brought her gun up.
Police!
Either the guy had heard Harry's first warning, or he had seen them out of the corner of his eye, because he was already scuttling toward the back of the restaurant between the tables. He had a handgun of his own, maybe a Browning 9mm, judging by the sound and by the glimpse she got. He was using it, too, firing at random, each shot thunderous in the confines of the restaurant. Beside Connie, a painted terracotta pot exploded. Chips of glazed clay showered onto her. The Dracaena marginata in the pot toppled over, raking her with long, narrow leaves, and she crouched even lower, trying to use a nearby table as a shield. She wanted in the worst way to get a shot at the bastard, but the risk of hitting one of the other customers was too great. When she looked across the restaurant at child's level, thinking maybe she could see him, a scattering of panicked, wide-eyed people had taken refuge under their tables.
Shit!
She pursued the geek while trying to make as small a target of herself as possible, aware that Harry was going after him from another direction. People were screaming because they were scared or had been shot and were in pain. The crazy bastard's gun boomed too often. Either he could change clips with superhuman speed, or he had another pistol. One of the big windows took a direct hit and came down in a jingle-jangle clangor. A waterfall of glass splashed across the cold Santa Fe tile floor. As Connie crept from table to table, her shoes picked up mashed French fries, ketchup, mustard, bits of oozing cacti, and crunching, tinkling pieces of glass. And as she passed the wounded, they cried out or pawed at her, desperate for help. She hated to ignore them, but she had to shake them off, keep moving, try to get a shot at the walking phlegm in the ultra suede coat. What meager first aid she might be able to provide wasn't going to help them. She couldn't do anything about the terror and pain the son of a bitch had already wrought, but she might be able to stop him from doing more damage if she stayed on his ass. She raised her head, risking a bullet in the brain, and saw the scumbag was all the way at the back of the restaurant, standing at a swinging door that had a glass porthole in the center. Grinning, he squeezed off rounds at anything that caught his attention, apparently equally pleased to hit a potted plant or a human being. He was still unnervingly ordinary in appearance, round-faced and bland with a weak chin and soft mouth. Even his grin failed to make him look like a madman. It was more the broad and affable smile of someone who had just seen a clown take a pratfall. But there was no doubt he was crazy dangerous, because he shot a big saguaro cactus, then a guy in a checkered shirt, the saguaro again, and he did have two guns, one in each hand. Welcome to the 1990s. Connie rose from shelter far enough to line up a shot. Harry was equally quick to take advantage of the lunatic's sudden obsession with the saguaro. He came to his feet in another part of the restaurant and fired. Connie fired twice. Chunks of wood exploded from the doorframe beside the psycho's head, and the glass blew out of the porthole. They had bracketed him by inches with their first shots. The geek vanished through the swinging door, which took both Harry's and Connie's next rounds and kept swinging. Judging by the size of the bullet holes, the door was hollow core, so the slugs might have gone through and nailed the son of a bitch on the other side. Connie ran toward the kitchen, slipping a little on the food-strewn floor. She doubted they were going to be lucky enough to find the creep wounded and squirming like a half-crushed cockroach on the other side of that door. More likely, he was waiting for them. But she couldn't rein herself in. He might even step through the door from that kitchen and cut her down as she approached, but her juices were up. She was jazzed. When her juices were up, she couldn't help but do everything full bore, and it didn't even matter that her juices were up most of the time. God, she loved this job. Harry hated this cowboy stuff. When you were a cop, you knew violence might come down sooner or later. You might suddenly find yourself up to your neck in wolves a lot nastier than any Red Riding Hood ever had to deal with. But even if it was part of the job, you didn't enjoy it. Well, maybe you did, if you were Connie Gulliver. As Harry rushed the kitchen door, going in low and fast with his revolver ready, he heard her behind him, feet slapping, crunching, squishing on the floor, coming full tilt. He knew that if he looked back at her, she would be grinning, not unlike the maniac who had shot up the restaurant, and although he knew she was on the side of the angels, that grin never failed to unnerve him. He skidded to a halt at the door, kicked it, and instantly jumped to one side, expecting an answering hail of bullets. But the door slammed inward, swung back out, and no gunfire followed. So when it swung inward again, Connie burst past him and went into the kitchen with it. He followed her, cursing under his breath, which was the only way he ever cursed. In the humid, claustrophobic confines of the kitchen, burgers sizzled on a grill and fat bubbled in a deep fryer. Pots of water boiled on a stovetop. Gas ovens creaked and popped from the intense heat they contained, and a bank of microwave ovens hummed softly. Half a dozen cooks and other employees, dressed in white slacks and T-shirts, their hair tucked under white string-tied caps pale as dead men, stood or cowered midst the culinary equipment. They were wrapped by curling tendrils of steam and meat smoke, looking less like real people than like ghosts. Almost as one, they turned toward Connie and Harry. "Where?" Harry whispered. One of the employees pointed toward a half-open door at the back of the kitchen. Harry led the way along a narrow aisle flanked on the left by racks of pots and utensils. On the right was a series of butcher blocks, a machine used to cut well-scrubbed potatoes into raw French fries, and another that shredded lettuce. The aisle widened into a clear space with deep sinks and heavy-duty commercial dishwashers along the wall to the left. The half-open door was about 20 feet directly ahead, past the sinks. Connie moved up to his side as they drew near the door. She kept enough distance between them to assure they couldn't both be taken out by one burst of gunfire. The darkness past that threshold bothered Harry. A windowless storeroom probably lay beyond. The smiling, moon-faced perp would be even more dangerous once cornered. After flanking the door, they hesitated, taking a moment to think. Harry would gladly have taken half the day to think, giving the perp plenty of time to stew in there, but that wasn't how it worked. Cops were expected to act rather than react. If there was a way out of the storeroom, any delay on their part would allow the perp to escape. Besides, when your partner was Connie Gulliver, you did not have the luxury of dawdling or ruminating. She was never reckless, always professional and cautious, but so quick and aggressive that it seemed sometimes as if she had come to homicide investigations by way of a SWAT team. Connie snatched up a broom that was leaning against the wall. Holding it near the base, she poked the handle against the half-open door, which swung inward with a protracted squeak. When the door was all the way open, she threw the broom aside. It clattered like old bones on the tile floor. They regarded each other tensely from opposite sides of the doorway. From above came soft laughter. Harry froze on the landing. He was confident that he was no longer backlit. He pressed tighter to the wall. Connie bumped into him and also froze. Harry waited for the queer laugh to come again. He hoped to get a fix precise enough to make it worth risking a shot and revealing his own location. Nothing. He held his breath. Then something thumped, rattled, thumped again, rattled, thumped again. He realized some object was rolling and bouncing down the steps toward them. What? He had no idea. His imagination deserted him. Thump, rattle, thump. Intuitively knew that whatever was coming down the stairs was not good. That's why the perp had laughed. Something small from the sound of it, but deadly in spite of being small. He was infuriated with himself for being unable to think, to visualize. He felt stupid and useless. A foul sweat suddenly sheathed him. The object hit the landing and rolled to a stop against his left foot. It bumped his shoe. He jerked back, then immediately squatted, blindly felt the floor, found the damn thing. Larger than an egg, but roughly egg-shaped, with the intricate geometric surface of a pine cone, heavier than a pine cone, with a lever on top.
Get down!
He stood and threw the hand grenade back into the upper hall before following his own advice and dropping as flat as possible on the landing. He heard the grenade clatter against something above. He hoped his throw had sent the damn thing all the way into the second floor hall, but maybe it bounced off a stairwell wall and was arcing down even now, the timer ticking off the last second or two before detonation. Or maybe it had barely landed in the upstairs hall and the perp had kicked it back at him. The explosion was loud, bright, cataclysmic. His ears rang painfully. Every bone seemed to vibrate as the blast wave passed through him, and his heartbeat accelerated, even though it had been racing already. Chunks of wood, plaster, and other debris rained over him, and the stairwell was filled with the acrid stench of burnt powder like a 4th of July night after a big fireworks display. He had a vivid mental picture of what might have happened if he had been 2 seconds slower, his hand dissolving in a spray of blood as he gripped the grenade upon detonation, his arm tearing loose of his body, his face crumpling in on itself.
What the hell?
Connie demanded, her voice close yet far away, distorted because Harry's ears were still ringing.
Grenade, he said, scrambling to his feet. Grenade? Who is this bozo?